previously.tvpodcastnetwork.
Are you okay? You look stressed.
I'm not sleeping. It's the crows in my neighborhood. They wake me up every morning. They're everywhere.
Signs and symbols, Ernie. The augury of birds, man. Mm. Come on. Paracelsus says this sort of thing usually foretells doom.
Fantastic.
I mean, that's just an FYI.
This is the Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 214 for the week of August 13th, 2018. I am Donut Shop Chess Set David T. Cole, and I'm here with Blindfold Protocol Sarah D. Bunting.
Bonk. Ow.
Metal Detective Tara Ariano.
Another bottle cap.
And Sovereign Protector Adam Sternberg.
No one else chose Sovereign Protector? I'll be Sovereign Protector.
Welcome to another episode of the podcast. Joining us this week is our beloved Adam Sternberg, returning guest. Hello, Adam.
Hello.
Hello, Adam.
Yay.
Yay! Adam chose Lodge 49 from a list of options that we could discuss as a lead topic this week. And you let me know over email earlier in the process that you watched the first one and you were not crazy about it. Tell us, first of all, what made you choose this among the options that were available? And did you watch more, and did you warm on it?
I choose Lodge 49, or did it choose me?
Oh,
that's the question.
Signs and symbols, Tara.
Someone threw a flyer in the window of your car and you were inexorably drawn to this topic.
I found the screener disc on the beach while I was searching with my metal detector. I chose this for a bunch of weird, disparate reasons, which is sort of thematically appropriate to the show itself. I had heard interesting things about it. I also realized it was one of the few options where it was a brand new show starting, so we could just start right from the beginning fresh. And I also have a weird sort of obsession with this kind of subgenre of noir fiction that's commonly called surf noir, which is about California and surfers and weird little surf towns where weird, strange things happen. So, and as I think we've discussed before, I also was kind of obsessed with / massively disappointed by John from Cincinnati, the weird pseudo surf noir show from HBO that David Milch did with this guy named Kem Nunn. So I sort of was hoping that this would be a kind of better, more accessible John from Cincinnati. And I feel like my verdict after having watched three episodes is sort of ? Yeah. The reason I said I had mixed feelings is, you know, my initial feeling in watching it is that I appreciated it more than I enjoyed it. And it feels like the kind of show that's more fun to write than it is to watch. It's a very kind of meandery, sort of gleefully pointless show that feels a little bit like someone skimmed the tone off a bunch of other things, like a Fargo, you know, a Coen Brothers movie, and a little bit of Charlie Kaufman, and then put it in a bag and with some sand and like shook it
up. Can I tell you what I told Tara earlier about
how to
nutshell this show? I described it as the Big Lebowski meets a 4-day weekend you forgot to plan for.
I thought it was pretty good.
Yeah. It's weird. Like I watched the episodes and I didn't hate them, but I feel no burning desire to continue watching them. And I feel like the show is going to be one of those classic. If the world turns around and tells me that Lodge 49 is completely worth investing 10 hours of your life in and that you have to watch it the way they did with, for example, The Leftovers, then maybe I will run back and watch the rest of the season. But, you know, it raises that eternal question where it's like, can you make a TV show where there are no stakes? And it seems like the show sort of gleefully is saying like, let's find out. But the problem is it doesn't have that, you know, it doesn't give you that burning reason to tune back into each new episode.
So it's really interesting that you bring that up, because one of my favorite things about this age of television and when new shows appear, because so many shows these days are mystery box shows, right? I mean, that's the easy way to get the 18 to 25 year old TV watcher involved, is to throw a mystery at them, a la Westworld or whatever, right? And these shows are just everywhere. So you get a show like this, and like the tricky call for the creators and the network is, here's a show that on the surface, the elevator pitch seems to be a mystery box show, but in fact, it's pretty character driven. And at least halfway through the first season, the mystery box elements are kind of background noise. So like, what's the equation for the creators and the network of how much character development do you get to do in the sort of like lazy slacker surfer way versus how long do you have to wait before you get to the hook of the show that you think you're odd, like that the general populace is going to want to come on board for? The first episode I thought wasn't quite the same tone as subsequent episodes. I actually think the third episode is where the series sort of finds its footing as far as the balance of that goes. It is interesting to me. It's very interesting to me, like in just sort of the commerce of television, like how much of this lazy Big Lebowski tone was fought for versus like how quickly are they going to get to the Lodge 49 fireworks factory that is sort of like the stonemasons sort of secret society, skull and bones, you know, kind of stuff. And they seem to be taking their sweet ass time with it. And although it sounds like maybe Adam and Sarah weren't on board, I actually like the more they just sort of kept that keel, the more I was getting into the characters, especially the sister Liz seems to be a really great character for this show. Like Adam said, it's like Coen Brothers light for TV. And I don't think it's going to set the world on fire, but I'm really looking forward to the back nine. Or the back five, as it were, for this.
Yeah, we watched the first five. Sarah, it sounds like you agreed with Adam's ruling on this. Tell us more about your reactions to the show.
Literally, my first note was, is this Wyatt from Cincinnati? I found this.
See, his name's Sean, and I said Sean from Cincinnati.
Sure. Yeah. Dud from Cincinnati.
Yeah.
I liked it more and more. I only watched two so far. And I agree that it's one of those that's like, I'm not sure that I have time for this, but I don't regret spending the time that I did spend. There are little moments like when they're giving away free mugs and the sister like yoinks a second one from off screen. This actor was on Olympus, Humans, which only I watched.
Yes.
And it's nice to see her American accent is pretty good. And it's nice to see her doing something that's not a sci-fi original. Sorry, sci-fi originals.
She was in Humans season three as well. And her American accent was so good. I actually looked it up to see if she was faking her British accent, which she's not. She is British.
Yes. In fact, I like her and her storyline and that little bit at Shamrocks, which is like, that's such low hanging fruit, that kind of bar, but it's very well observed. And the actor playing her manager, Jeremy, is like, I always like that guy too. There's really a lot to like here. And one of the things I like best about it is this Terriers-y feel to it.
Yeah.
That's like, Terriers is more like desert California noir, and this is more beach California noir, but I think that Wyatt Russell is very likable. You said on Twitter, Tara, I think that you did not care for him before, but he was growing on you because of this.
Yeah, I always thought he was kind of a nothing, and I mean he's perfect. I feel like he's perfectly cast for this part, and that makes me like him more because I've seen him in other things. The first big thing I think I saw him in was in his season three episode of Black Mirror.
Sure. And then I've also seen him in, it's weird because his father comes through just enough.
Yeah.
But then it also reminded me of that whole family talking about the minor league team that his grandfather, Kurt's father, used to own.
Uh-huh.
Bing Russell, like what a name for a minor league baseball team owner. That's a very good documentary. It's on Netflix. You should all check it out. But he's very good. This kind of role could be super annoying super easily. Like, I'm actually not a huge Lebowski fan. Don't at me. And it's, I mean, it's not because of the performance. It's just that this sort of catch as catch can stoner free spirit is a very tired character trope, but his portrayal is really good. Like, I am looking forward to coming back to it and just seeing what all these characters are getting up to, because they cast some really good, hey, it's that guys in this. And mm-hmm. I kind of like a show that looks at like regular people who are not 26 years old and wearing, you know, Louboutins to their ADA job. Like, I like that. It has texture. I'm just not sure. It's what Dave was saying. Like, in this era, are they going to be able to strike the right pace of how much they give away about the puzzle to keep people coming back? And also, do I personally have time for this? Like, I want to get back to it, but I'm not sure how high a priority it's going to be.
Yeah, I think if you watch the first three episodes of this show and you're not in it for all the reasons it presents in those first three shows or episodes, rather, then I would say bail, because like, I don't think this is a show that's really going to wholeheartedly embrace its mystery box like a show like Westworld is. You know, like Westworld, like this show has sort of like a emotional ecosystem sort of between all the characters, where the Lodge is the epicenter of all these characters' lives, and you know, there's all these vignettes about them, and you know, they pass in and out of each other. But like Westworld, they're all sort of like cogs in the machine, no pun intended, but like they're all in service of what's going on, and that's the only reason for the show, right? So I think, like, I would say, like, yes, is this a mystery box show? Probably, but it's more like a mystery box as background show more than a lot of other stuff we've seen in the past.
Like, that's how it got sold, but it's actually about him. So, yeah.
Yeah.
I agree with Sarah in that my hesitation in the first episode is I thought, oh, this is going to be one of those shows where they're asking us to hang out with a bunch of characters sort of televisually who, if we actually encountered them in real life, would be just incredibly annoying. Like, there was one scene in the first episode where they almost lost me, where where Wyatt Russell's character Dud is hanging out in this sort of empty rental apartment and he's drinking whiskey, and then the landlord comes in with some prospective renters and he goes to hide in the closet and they discover him, and it's sort of this moment where the show's like, oh, look at this quirky Dud, he's hanging out in his underwear in someone's apartment, but you're like, that guy kind of belongs in prison. Like, he seems really irritating, and if this whole show is going to be built around him, and there was a little bit of a sort of forced quirkiness factor in the first episode. There was an exchange with the woman that he sees where she's like, it turns out that she went to homecoming with him and they know each other from high school. And then she makes this comment to her, I guess, fiance who's with her, that she gave him a blowjob. And you're like, okay, none of this would ever happen in any universe that involves real people really interacting with other real people.
Yeah.
So I worried that the show was just going to be like a quirk on a quirk on a quirk. But as I was watching, I did sort of become more affectionate to the characters. I agree that the character of the sister is quite good. And Wyatt Russell is sort of genetically engineered to play this role. Like, it's the combination of Kurt Russell and Goldie Hawn, right? Yeah. And Brett Jennings, who plays the other sort of main character in the show, Ernie, he's very good as well. But really it's that, and the scene that sort of made me sit up a little bit straighter is when they reveal the London office of the Lodge.
Yes.
And there's sort of this suggestion that there's this kind of Byzantine world of these lodges, and that this one lodge is kind of the ne'er-do-well slacker outpost of it. And I got really interested in like what that world's going to be, but I just don't know how much of that world we're going to see and how long I want to wait around to see it.
Mm. Well, and when is that world is my question. It had this very like Calling the Watchers Council feel to it.
Yeah. I said to Dave, the care that they put into like creating the world of the lodge, like, you know, it's the Lynx Lodge, and they, you know, they have these like sort of costumey things that they wear for their meetings, and then, you know, the London office, and all of the, you know, the premise behind it is the alchemy, but it's only allegorical. You're not supposed to take it literally, as Blaze has to keep telling Dud as he's, you know, trying to move up the ranks and stuff. All of that is very pleasing to me. And Dave said, I'm not surprised it scratches the same itch in you that likes faux industrial films or training films in TV and movies, which I do. That's another trope that I love very much. So all of that was really enjoyable to me. Like, I felt like that goes such a long way to creating the world. But also, like, the, you know, you mentioned Brett Jennings and Wyatt Russell, but, like, the fact that this is executive produced by Paul Giamatti, it kind of makes me think, like, he just wanted to back this project so he could cast every amazing New York theater actor that he personally loves. And I'm with it. Like, I think that's a perfectly fine reason to make a show most of the time. But we haven't really talked much about the plot, but there's not really that much to say. There's this guy, Dud, Wyatt Russell character. He's, you know, really down in his luck because his father has just died. His twin sister has her life only marginally more together than he does. And we find out over the first several episodes that their dad was, you know, had this pool cleaning business that Dud used to work for. And then he fell on hard times and took out a whole bunch of debt and has passed away, maybe by accident and maybe not. And Dud is sort of led to the lodge first by finding this a signet ring for it. And then his car runs out of gas right in front of it. And, you know, there's mystical elements as well. And I guess it's only really this and Big Lebowski and John from Cincinnati that I've seen. Is the mystical element sort of part of the surf noir genre, Adam? Is that traditionally really, a trope or a motif that runs through them?
There's certainly a lot of talk about Zen and the sort of mystic element of surfing and how when you go out surfing, you're kind of one with the element. I would say what's missing here is the noir element. Because in surf noir, to me, what's always the interesting juxtaposition is the sort of laid back surface quality of the surfing lifestyle and these sort of placid, idyllic California seaside towns. And then this idea that there's some kind of crazy thing happening beneath the surface, you know, whether it's like someone is running a porn ring or there's a murder or, you know, whatever it is. And that's often what noir is about. Right. And so, you know, someone had this smart idea to say, oh, like, what if we set a noir mystery in a surf town as opposed to a city? But in this show, there's no, the real tension, there's no crime, there's no sort of investigation, no one's missing, which is fine, but there's nothing to kind of fill that vacuum to give you the propulsive reason to keep going. And, you know, I feel like the one tension in the show, as Dave said, is like, to what extent is the mystical lodge that is the underpinning to this really mystical, and how crazy is the world that we're going to discover? But my hunch is not that mystical. I'm not sure. There's a thing that happens at the end of episode 3, which made me raise an eyebrow, but I don't know if I'm going to keep going to find out. Again, it's like, if people tell me that it pays off, then I'll probably circle back.
Well, and that was one thing that was like, all right, well, I'm going to keep watching until it's like been confirmed that Dud Senior is actually dead. Cause I'm not, and you don't have to tell me either way. I'm just not convinced, but it's interesting that Animal Kingdom is inhabiting like the same basic physical world as this, but is shot with completely different filters, and it's like no surf, all noir. So maybe they just need to the Lodge Kingdom 49 and just merge them all together. Cause I like Animal Kingdom, but that darkness is relentless, and yet it's constant. Like the way it's shot is just like constant, almost burnt out sunlight.
Yeah.
And this is very different. Like there's a lot of fogginess in this one. So yeah, I mean, I am intrigued.
An interesting animal for a TV show. I imagine it was a really hard sell, and imagine even, you know, Paul Giamatti had to really, you know, go in there guns blazing to get this on the air. But it's like a really good balancing act. Like, and I think a lot of the problems, I think you have to like at least get to episode 2, because in episode 1, you know, it's got some pilotitis to it, but you know, it's the balance of whimsy without getting too like fey is well done after the first episode. You know, the character versus mystery box stuff, I feel, is refreshingly on the character side of things. And, you know, if you had to say like, well, what is this? Is it a dramedy? Is it a comedy? Is it a dramedy? It's like, it's a little comedy, and it's like drama on weedy. Like it's an interesting show, and I wouldn't begrudge anybody watching the first couple episodes and saying you're nuts, this is the most boring slow burn TV show in the world. Like I think you're just gonna hook into the characters and enjoy the sort of weird background that is Lodge 49 for all these characters, or you're not. And I think, like, it's fine if you're not. You know what I mean? Like, this is not, like, super important TV that all the critics are going to cross their arms and stare at you disapprovingly if you don't like. Like, this is definitely super niche-y show, and I think you're going to be just sort of, like, charmed by the characters and want to see where they go, or you're not. You're not going to come into this show for the same reasons you may come into Westworld or something like that.
Yeah, Adam, I would say watch maybe one more, because episode 4 is, like, all takes place on the same day as episode 3, and it's the aftermath of the event that closes episode 3, but it's also a lot of just Dud and Ernie driving around trying to find someone and, like, getting to know each other, and that's, I think that's the high point of the ones that we've watched so far. We watched, as I said, five of the 10. And okay. It's good. And if you still aren't convinced after that one, I think you're okay to bail. But yeah, I was surprised Dave wanted to watch as many as he did.
I'm kind of surprised too, but that makes me more intrigued. And I do think the show has, like, it has good taste. Like, there's good moments. It's well directed. It's well cast. There's little quirky things that happen where you go, oh yeah, that's a funny observation about life. There's a moment where the sister is in traffic and someone's honking at her and she's stuck there. And then she says, why are you honking? And she gets out and yells. And it turns out to be this, like, completely obnoxious vape store guy that we just met. And I was like, that is 100% a thing that happened to someone in the writer's room of this show. Like, that's just an observed piece of California life. So that makes me have some faith in it and makes me feel like if the overall plot can be just interesting enough, then it would be worth going back to.
It's time to go around the dial. Let's talk about what we're watching these days. First stop, Tara Ariano.
Insecure is back. Insecure is back for season 3. It's a weirdly appropriate bookend to Lodge 49, actually, because both of them are about being economically insecure in California in this time. Actually, it's not clear that to back up slightly, it's not clear what time it is. When Dud gets a phone, it's a flip phone. So maybe it is supposed to be earlier than our current day, but never mind. Issa is back. She is still at her terrible job, but now she's also lifting because she left her apartment at the end of season 2. And now she's sleeping on Daniel's couch, and it is terrible because they have no boundaries and neither knows what they want from the other. But her relationship with Molly is still great. Molly is also trying to set her boundaries with Dro, the married guy that she's sleeping with, because he has an open relationship as far as she knows. The first episode is very good. I hadn't realized how much I missed it until it came back. And there's a whole long sequence where Issa gets Molly to go with her driving Lyft by calling it the party Lyft. And they pick up a couple of really young girls on their way to the club who then rate Issa and Molly with afterwards. They think they were all having fun and having snacks and stuff, and then find out that these girls thought it was like getting a lift from your aunties, which is a really mean neck because they're only in their 30s. Insecure is one of the best shows on television. I'm so happy it's back. If you have not watched it, the first 2 seasons are really short. They're all on HBO Go. It's tremendous, and everyone should watch it because it's very good. HBO Sunday nights. And for my plug, I was on the I Hate It But I Love It podcast talking about Bring It On last week, which is super duper fun. You can find it in the show notes. And I also want to plug the Claws season 2 finale recap is also up at previously.tv, and that closes the chapter with a lot of my complaints about what the show gets wrong about how businesses work and how the law works
and how voices work. Thank you. It was an excellent recap, and not just because it was frustrated with it in exactly the same ways that I was.
Yeah, I mean, it just, you know, here's one piece of paper for you to sign over $68 million worth of real estate to me. Like, no, that's not how it works. But whatever. I still love Niecy Nash, and I will cape for that show for as long as it is on. But it does frustrate me. So I'm glad that we can take a break from each other for that reason.
Adam J. Sternberg.
I'm going to talk about my absolute favorite show of the last few years. I begged Tara to let me talk about this, even though it's not technically back in any meaningful way, though you can go and watch it right now. I intend to rewatch it shortly, and that is Babylon Berlin on Netflix.
What is this? I have barely heard of it except for you and Catherine Van Aaron talking about it.
Oh, allow me to proselytize. So, and there's a vague news peg to this, which is that they just announced that season 3 of Babylon Berlin has gone into production in Germany. So that means that we should be seeing the episodes on Netflix, I'm guessing, early next year. But the first two seasons are on Netflix right now. Okay. And I feel like one of the great travesties of the year, I mean, it's not really in the top 10,000 great travesties of the year, but that this show somehow did not become like one of those cult talk about shows on Netflix. There's some obvious impediments to that happening. For example, the show's in German and comes with subtitles. You can watch it with dubbed dialogue, but I highly recommend you watch it in the original German. So the show is a German production. It stars no one you've ever seen before. It's all European actors. It's filmed in Germany. The only person who's involved in it, who you probably have heard of, is this director, Tom Twyker,
who did
Run Lola Run, and is like a big deal film producer in Germany. And when they made this show, it's financed by Sky TV, who has a lot of money, and it's the most expensive show ever produced in mainland Europe. And the idea was that the German television industry was going to take this big home run swing and try to make a show that would break out internationally. And it has gotten quite a bit of attention, and you can watch it on US Netflix. And it is a sort of, it's a procedural cop show with a little bit of noir. It takes place in Weimar Germany, so sort of pre-Nazi era. Some people have described it as like Cabaret meets The Wire, which in a weird way doesn't do it justice, but it is very vivacious. It's an incredible period recreation. The production design is so beautiful. You can't believe that they were able to. I mean, it literally, to me, is the most production-wise, it's the most impressive show I've seen other than Game of Thrones. It looks that good. And
wow,
the recreations of like 1920s and early 1930s Germany are so beautiful. The cast is uniformly excellent because they have a lot of good actors in Europe that you've never heard of. And it's about it's nominally about this police officer who comes from Cologne to Berlin at this very sort of tentous moment and gets involved in this crazy conspiracy involving a train full of gold and lost heiresses and Russian intrigue and, of course, the rise of the Nazis, although that part of it is like very much in the background. But it's also got these lavish musical numbers. It's got dream sequences. It has these sort of fantastic breakout performances from these different actors, including this woman named Liv Lisa Fries, who plays this young woman who starts out as kind of a typesetter / prostitute and becomes a homicide detective.
Hang on. Typesetter / prostitute. Does she do her own flyers?
She's a typist. And a prostitute. It's daytime, nighttime. She's moonlighting. Okay. She's got a side hustle.
Man, you know, I haven't heard of this show, but I took 2 years of German history, like Weimar German history in university. So finally, a use for those 2 years.
Well, I only heard about it because someone on Twitter literally just tweeted at me and said, you would like this show.
Yeah.
And I watched the first 10 minutes of the first episode and I was like, I am all in on this. This is exactly what I want to watch. And I will say one thing about it, and there's a bit of a thematic thread I realized in hindsight between the shows we're talking about today, between Lodge 49 and this show and Killing Eve. I've had this sort of unspoken beef with like American peak TV, which I like to call creeping what the fuckism, where it's like everyone's decided that the hallmark of a quality show is that you never know what the fuck's going on at any given time. And that somehow is like the earmark of quality. And this show is very old fashioned in the sense that it doesn't try to confuse you. There's no puzzle to solve. It's just about these compelling characters who are very rich, very well drawn, being put into these sort of morally complicated situations and having to like figure out what to do in the way that The Wire was sort of like that. And then it also recalls The Wire because it just pulls out, and you start to see more and more layers of this world until you feel like you're getting this very intricate portrait of this period, this, you know, obviously very portentous moment in history. It's so good. The two people in the world who love it, which are me and Catherine von Aaron, will we talk about it to each other incessantly. I tell you, if you watch literally the first 10 minutes of the first episode, you'll know if it's your for you or not. But it's so good. And it's just waiting there for you to watch it. And my PSA is that it's confusing because Netflix has packaged the first two seasons as one season. So it just says it's a 16 episode season.
Oh, okay.
And then you get news that like, oh, season three is coming out. So what happened to season two? The first two seasons are available. Season three is in production. Go watch the first two seasons now. And then you, like me, will be waiting impatiently for the third one. But
that
sounds
my great.
Highest yeah. recommendation.
Sounds like a weekend project for us, Tara.
Yeah, you will zoom through. There's the 16 episodes are an hour each, and you could easily watch them in like a week to 10 days. It's the first show I've watched in
week
quite a while.
Week to 10 days? Man, that's lightweight.
Jeez. He has a kid. Yeah.
10 hours to a day.
Yeah.
No, I this was the first show I've watched probably since Breaking Bad, where I had that, you know, Portlandia, like one more thing, where yeah. I just was like, I could stay up till 2 a.m. It's all right. We'll just watch one more episode. It's so compelling. For my plug,
woo!
I wrote a book called The Blinds. It's a thriller, a bit of a noir thriller itself. It does not take place in a surf town. It takes place in Western Texas. And it has come out in paperback. It's coming out actually the day that we're recording this. So by the time you hear this, it will be in the world, available at all your favorite bookstores. Please go and check it out. And if you like it or you want to tweet at me about it, you can find me on Twitter at Sternberg. Is my thing. If you pick it up, let me know. I would be very happy to hear about it. But just
I ear read it via Audible, so just know that if you you know, need something else to put in your ear holes instead of this podcast, it is available there as well.
Yes. Yeah, we'll link your Twitter and to the book's website in the show notes.
Can you give like a elevator description of what the book's about?
It takes place in a remote town in Western Texas. It's 100 miles from civilization, and all the population of the town are made up of ex-criminals who've had all memory of their criminality erased. So it's sort of like Lost meets the Witness Protection Program. And then something bad happens.
Oh, no.
Oh, then something bad happens.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Okay, speaking of something bad... I finally got around to watching Newspaper Man, The Life and Times of Ben Bradlee, which is an HBO documentary. I'm sure you can find it on HBO Go. Should you? Well, here's the thing. I have watched All the President's Men and been self-soothing with not just that, but other Watergate-iana as much as anyone in the last year and a half. But I really did not like Bradlee's memoir, and this film is based heavily on it. It's a perfectly competent build of a documentary. The director has done a whole shit ton of American experiences and front lines. And it's partly voiced over by Bradlee's audiobook reading of his memoir, which is pretty much the same specious performative mea culpa as the text. He asks himself a bunch of rhetorical questions about his nature and his guilt and morality when he leaves yet another wife to the drudgery of raising the umpteen kids that they had together to trade up, quote unquote, to a younger model. It's the way it's done is just highly self-serving, and it doesn't make him any less great of a reporter or an editor or a public steward of our democracy, but I just wish that this documentary, as well as his memoir, had stuck to that and not brought his, frankly, to me, repellent personality into it. The highly disingenuous self-reporting of his various love affairs does not make for a particularly attractive 90 minutes, but it is only 90 minutes of your life versus reading the book, which I struggled resentfully through over the course of a weekend. And this does not spend what felt like months, like in real time in the Pacific theater of his wartime exploits on some boat, whatever. Sorry, Greatest Generation, but who cares? Anyway, this sat on my DVR for 8 months and it probably should have just been left there. So I would go back and watch All the President's Men again. It's a little longer, but it's a lot of fun.
The Post is going to be on HBO in 8 minutes too, I'm sure.
Yes, which equally big part of his you know, working story. And the Post was a perfectly pleasant, like, Watergate soother of the past. So, yeah, not great, Bob Woodward. I can, however, speaking of Watergate, I can recommend our next episode of The Blotter Presents that will have dropped by the time you're listening to this. And Alex Collins and I are talking about Slow Burn. Their first season was about Watergate, but the second one is about Bill Clinton's high crimes and misdemeanors. And we're talking about that and CNN's Patty Hearst podcast, which was called Patty Has a Gun. We had a lot of fun drawing parallels between, quote, Tanya and Monica Lewinsky. How did we do that? You will have to listen and find out. That is The Blotter Presents, available on all your fine podcast apps and also all the other ones.
Tara wanted me to talk about The Venture Brothers, which is back, and I didn't really have a lot to say except it seems to be continuing its return to form that it started last season, so that's nice. A lot less creepy underage girl jokes that the creators seem to think it was really funny from a couple seasons ago, so Yeah, on that.
Clancy Brown made his debut as the mask of a Red Death character with a daughter that had the same face as him in pigtails, which was very cute and funny.
I think that's a returning character.
Oh, is he? Okay, I didn't remember him. But the second episode is very Jawsy, and that was also extremely entertaining.
Yeah, it was really good. The homage that isn't like just like we did it just like Jaws, so it's funny, right? Which is a really annoying thing in the last 10 years. They actually purposefully.
Yeah, they worked in my favorite new character on the time that we obviously went to see it on July 4th at the Alamo Draft House because of America. But the character that I noticed this time was the one on the dock at some point where they say whatever. He only has one line and it's, oh, what? Like, just really weird, over-the-top, fruity 70s, like, fisherman. And that character made it into this episode of Venture Brothers, which is like, okay, all-time classic, because they love that guy, too.
Yeah. And when, Adam, you were talking about somebody on Twitter just pinging you, telling you to watch Babylon Berlin, it reminded me that we had a Cannes submission a couple months ago by Josh Gondelman, writer of... Did you listen? Have you watched the characters Tim Robbins episode?
I did watch it. I watched it because I heard that Cannes submission from Josh Gondelman, who I also know from Twitter and follow on Twitter. And I did watch it, and then I showed it to my wife, and it was as funny as advertised.
Okay, good.
I have to say.
As soon as you mentioned, I was like, oh my God, this is Sternberg Nip. He's got to watch this. So yeah.
Yeah. Especially, I have to say that first one, that is just was 100% in my wheelhouse. Whatever his name, Johnny Fantastic or Sammy
Roulette. The Rat Pack guy.
Yeah. And and those sketches were such simple premises, but just perfectly crafted, perfectly developed. Never like, you know, the dead horse was beat just enough times and then it was out. Yeah. And I was simultaneously like exhilarated because I had discovered this thing, but then vaguely depressed because I was like, how many things like this are there in the world that I'm not going to discover because I happened to hear someone recommend it on a podcast? But yes, I 100% ran out and watched it, and I am a satisfied customer.
Oh, good. I'm glad. The thing I wanted to talk about for my subject here is we bought, as a treat to ourselves when we relocated here to Austin, so I went out and bought a nice big 4K television. We had not yet entered the 4K timeline. And I did a little research, asked our friend Omar, who's the tech writer for the Austin Statesman's here, to confirm that the TV set that I was thinking of was the right one. And for those that are curious, we got a LG OLED 4K TV. I think it's 60 inches. It's pretty big. And you want to get OLED because that's the way you get those true blacks, whereas a traditional TV, black is just as little light as possible. On OLEDs, black is black because instead of one big light, it's actually every pixel is its own, you know, flat, you know, light bulb, so to speak. So it's really nice. I really love 4K television. There's not a lot of it yet. Netflix seems to be where you're going to get most of it. But DirecTV DirecTV and all those kind of things, like, they're generally doomed. Like, you know, I think the writing's on the wall that, you know, eventually all our television will be IPTV. It will be going over the internet rather than
Don't say that.
Beaming between dishes. But how has DirecTV, they just ignore 4K interfaces. So if you're on a 4K TV, all your menus, all your, you know, guides and recording lists, they're all still in 1080, which is like one quarter the resolution of a 4K television, pretty much. So everything is like a little bit blurry and a little bit blobby, and nothing really looks crisp. And it just makes me feel like DirecTV doesn't care about me. I spend so much time on a computer and dealing with UI and UX stuff. It really bugs me when something like such a big entity like DirecTV can't get off their ass and do a 4K version of their interface. Like, it is not a small project, but it's not such a big project that it couldn't have been done by now. Like, I'm a pretty late, comer to 4K television. They've been out for a long time. And, you know, if you go to Costco or you go to Best Buy, like, pretty much that's all you can buy. Like, anything that's over 40 inches is 4K now. And then, like, you know, the budget ones are 1080, the ones you can buy for, you know, $180 now, you know, like your 32 inch TVs. So I don't know. It just really bugs me that I have a 4K everything. You know, the Apple TV's 4K, and we were watching, you know, Mad Max in 4K, and it looks absolutely amazing. And you watch Netflix, new Netflix shows that they make themselves, and they're in 4K and they look great. And then you go to fucking DirecTV, and it's like this bullshit menu that looks like you've
Pong
scanned a VIC-20 to, you know, to your
it's
HDTV.
True. It does
I'm
look
just
bad.
Saying this is why, you know, DirecTV is why we can't have nice things. And it really bugs me. Tara, your thoughts?
Don't be mad at me, DirecTV. I still love you.
It is time for the canon. Submitting this week, Adam Sternberg. Take it away, Adam.
My submission for the canon this week is a bit of a departure for me, because in my previous submissions, I've tended towards older episodes of older shows, kind of classic TV, and what I thought was playing it safe. This time, I wanted to submit a brand piping, fresh, hot new show, which is Killing Eve, Season 1, Episode 1. Episode title is Nice Face. And now, there, as I mentioned, talking about Babylon Berlin, I feel like there's shows that like the whole world tells you to watch all at the same time. I feel like that happened this summer with Succession. All of a sudden, everyone just decided like you have to watch Succession, and you hear this sort of general drumbeat. Mm-hmm. And then there's sort of bespoke shows that get recommended to you specifically by people who say, oh, you should check out Killing Eve. This show for me was both. I, you know, everyone was talking about it. And at the same time, individual people were saying to me, oh, you should check this out. It's really up your alley. And yet, initially, I resisted. And the reason I resisted is because I enjoy a good procedural. I enjoy a good spy thriller, so much so that I've actually watched quite a few of them. And I just looked at it and thought, you know, I've watched The Fall. I've watched a lot of sort of procedural shows about like obsessive investigators tracking brilliant killers. And then it turns out they're not quite as different as you'd think, really two sides of the same coin. And as much as I love Sandra Oh, which I do, you know, I just, this really went on the back burner for me. I was intrigued by the involvement of Phoebe Waller-Bridge, who, is also known for creating and starring in and writing Fleabag, which I know you guys recently inducted the pilot of that series into the canon. And the juxtaposition of I knew her work from Fleabag, and the idea of seeing what she would do with a spy thriller was intriguing to me. Then, by fortunate happenstance, I broke my foot and I was couch bound for at least a week. And I sat down and watched the entire season of Killing Eve, and I thought it was brilliant. And I especially thought that the very first episode was exceptionally good. And the reason being that, as Dave alluded, there's sort of this phenomenon of pilotitis. We kind of grade pilots on a curve, because pilots are so hard. You have to introduce the characters. You have to introduce the premise. You have to introduce the complication that's going to drive the series forward. And you have to do all that in sort of a 45 to 1 hour package of television. And usually pilots are very overstuffed and confusing, and it takes a little while for the show to sort of find its legs. I think this pilot is so well conceived and so well executed, and demonstrates all the things that are sort of interesting about the series as a whole. That's why I chose to submit this episode for the canon. So the basic premise of Killing Eve is we have this investigator played by Sandra Oh. Her name is Eve Pulaski. And we have this sort of glamorous assassin, Pollastri. We have this glamorous assassin played by Jodie Comer, who we learn is named Villanelle. The first scene of the show, the cold open, we get the requisite huge letter title card. They're in Vienna, and there's this kind of interesting little vignette that plays out where Villanelle is sitting in an ice cream parlor, and she sees this little girl eating ice cream. And she's kind of staring at the little girl, and she smiles at her, and the girl doesn't smile back. And then the girl does start smiling at someone else, and Villanelle looks over and realizes that she's responding to the sort of affectionate gaze of the ice cream store attendant. At this moment, when I first watched this, I thought, okay, she's going to kill the attendant. That's going to be the sort of stunning cold open for the show to show how brutal she is. She's going to murder this guy because he's creepy, because he's smiling at a little girl. What actually happens, I never could have predicted. She stands up. She checks her watch. There's a tiny drop of blood on her watch, which is a perfect little touch. She stands up. She walks out of the store. And as she's walking out, she dumps the ice cream into the lap of the little girl. Which sort of announces everything that the show is going to be about. It's all about this idea of like how we look at women, how women look at each other, the sort of preconceptions we have about people, what happens when people start to test their own preconceptions. And also the show sort of says, there's no boundaries here. We're going to go there. We're going to dump a bowl of ice cream into a little kid's lap. We're actually going to do worse to a little kid later in the show. So immediately I was intrigued. And then we go into the show. We then meet Sandra Oh's character, Eve, and this is a classic genre trope, right? In a spy thriller or a cop show, it's the hero who wakes up screaming from a bad dream. This is to communicate that the hero is haunted and complicated by some sort of mysterious past. Immediately, we meet Sandra Oh. She wakes up. She's screaming. Her husband's shaking her. What is it, Eve? What is it? What is it? And she says, oh, I fell asleep on both of my arms. And then when he reacts, she's like, what? It really hurt. And again, I felt like this is the show saying to you, we're not going to avoid the tropes. We're not going to ignore them. What we're going to do is we're going to subvert all of them. We know that you know what to expect, and we're going to use those expectations against you, both to make you laugh and also to make you think and to work towards the sort of thematic, overall thematic concerns of the show. So the first clip that I have here is an interaction between Eve and her assistant, Elena, who's played by Kirby Howell Batiste. And this, weirdly enough, I feel like this minute is maybe the most well-crafted minute of the whole episode. So why don't we listen to the clip?
Well, at least we have the whole weekend to record.
Oh, my God.
Happy Saturday. You were superb last night.
Thank you.
What's going on? Oh, did you get me a croissant?
No. Do you want the rest of this?
Of course I want the rest of that. How are you so perky? You left after I did.
I went for a run this morning, then I ate some coal. Apparently it's a thing. I feel great. Okay, from what I can eavesdrop on, a Russian sex trafficking politician's been murdered in Vienna.
Oh, no.
I know. Bum out.
Why are they crying about it here?
Don't know.
Was it a contract kill?
I don't know.
You really earn your money, you know.
I have no idea what we do here.
Get me a croissant.
Right.
Everyone's in there with Frank.
Go. And, oh, Lord, it's Carolyn Martins.
Who?
MI6 Russia desk. Oh, I'd nail a cousin to work with that woman. Stone cold badass.
Well, I'll put in a good word.
No, please don't. You're the late one.
What I love about this exchange, it's kind of a standard TV walk and talk where you're getting some exposition, but we've never met these two characters essentially before. We know very little about them, and we learn everything about the relationship that we need to know in this 1 minute. The whole back and forth about the croissant, like, oh, you didn't get me one. Oh, is that what I'm supposed to do? I don't even know what we do here. But then she actually did get the croissant, and that actually becomes a sort of recurring joke through the next scene too. Their whole interaction feels very human. It's very funny. And also, it communicates to you that, you know, often when you sit down to watch a show, you think you know what you're going to get. You're either going to get thrills and violence and excitement, or you're going to get sort of funny back and forth between snarky characters in like a relationship comedy. This show kind of says it's the whole smorgasbord. You're going to get a little bit of everything. So just sit back and get ready to be entertained. The next clip is just one line, but I wanted to include it here. So let's listen to that.
Well, thank you all for giving us your Saturday. Turns out people are still murderous bastards on the weekend.
This is Frank, who is their boss, trying to be funny at the beginning of this meeting. And I love that strange, awkward, strangulated little laugh he gives at the end of his failed joke. And this is the moment where I felt like the show announces to us that this is going to be all kinds of shows. It's going to be a procedural, yes. It's going to be a spry thriller, yes. But it's also going to be the kind of funny workplace comedy that British people do so well. That these characters are going to feel human and they're going to feel relatable even as they go through sort of insane experiences involving espionage and murder and poison dispensing hair clips. It also starts, you know, this scene also starts to introduce a lot of the ways in which the show is going to subvert the tropes of the genre and start using them in service of the larger thematic concerns of the show, which are how we see women, how women see each other, and how women exist both in this familiar genre and also in the larger world. And the show is going to do all that while being both wildly entertaining and genuinely laugh out loud funny. Then in the next section, we meet Villanelle. So she's obviously the counterpart to Eve. She's beautiful and slightly strange. She has a weird relationship with other women. She's always kind of checking them out. We've already seen her dump ice cream into the lap of a little girl. She has a funny exchange with her frumpy landlady who ends up calling her an asshole twice. And then we see, again, a sort of familiar genre scene. She gets home to her apartment slash lair. She puts her wig away. She's completed her assignment. There's a great visual gag where she pulls out a drawer and there's a box of bullets and a box of tampons side by side, and they sort of visually echo each other. And this is kind of a pattern throughout the show. Each of the scenes is sort of familiar. It hits all the beats of the genre. We're going to see the scene where the glamorous assassin is unpacking. We're going to see the scene in which the glamorous assassin figures out a brilliant way to assassinate someone. We're going to see the scene where the investigator has a hunch about the person that no one else believes, but she can't let it go, so she's worrying away about it. But every time they introduce it, the writing is also going to undercut it in a way that actually makes you think about what those scenes mean and work towards the sort of thematic resonance of the whole show. It's hard. One of the difficulties with this in drawing clips is that much of the scenes with Villanelle in the first episode don't take place in English. So it's a little tricky to pull clips from her, but I have some good ones later on. We see an elaborate scene where she murders an Italian sort of tycoon in a scene that I think very consciously mirrors The Godfather. And in fact, I looked up on the second viewing whether the dress that Villanelle wears is sort of an homage to the dress that Michael Corleone's Italian bride wears in the extended Italian sequence in The Godfather, because I feel like there has to be a conscious echo here. And when you think about that character in The Godfather, she exists in that movie only to be murdered. She can't even speak English. She basically shows up, she is beautiful, she is murdered, and she then sends the male protagonist off on his the rest of his sort of journey. And I feel like this is one of the shows that the things that this show does really smartly. It makes these sort of nods to these other genre staples, but says, like, think about how these characters exist. Think about what they're used for, and we're going to do it differently. The next clip is an exchange between Eve and her husband, and it's kind of a telling exchange and gets at this notion that these characters aren't exactly what we think they are when we first see them.
How would you kill me if you could?
I don't know. Push you down the stairs?
No, seriously, they come for you immediately.
I don't know. Flatter you to death. Okay. How would you kill me?
I'd paralyze you with saxitoxin and suffocate you in your sleep. Chop you into the smallest bits I could manage, boil you down, put you in a blender, then take you to work in a flask and flush you down a restaurant toilet.
You've really thought about that.
Smart, huh?
Very.
Sexy?
Hugely.
Do you want supper?
Ooh, yes. Thank you.
Okay. Love you.
Love you.
What I love about this exchange is that, you know, what we've seen of Eve already is she's sort of this vaguely disorganized, kind of flighty functionary at work who's like complaining because no one bought her a croissant. But here we see that, you know, these are things that she's thought about. She's actually quite diabolical. And there's a side to her, not only that we're seeing for the first time, but that she's seeing for the first time. And that through the course of the series, she's going to be encountering more and more of this part of herself that's sort of fascinated with power and fascinated with death and all the sort of themes of the show. And I love how the kind of traditional gender roles are swapped in this scene, and the husband becomes sort of dismissive, and he's got that patronizing line where he says, "I don't know, I guess I'd flatter you to death." And then the response is to say, "Well, I would chop you into little pieces and flush you down a restaurant toilet." So that kind of tension is what I think makes the show so electric. And I really, this is where the writing of Phoebe Waller-Bridge really comes through, and I think is really, really smart. I wanted to have at least one clip of Villanelle. So this clip is Villanelle interacting with her handler, Constantine, who we've only briefly met, and we're not entirely sure yet what the nature of their relationship is. But let's listen to that clip.
3 days ago, one of Moscow's most controversial politicians was found professionally murdered in a pretty street in Vienna. Very good. The murder took place in a CCTV blind spot. Also good. The politician's girlfriend was reportedly with him while he died. Fine. And was not harmed. Not so good. She is currently in London, where she will be interviewed as a principal witness to the murder. Bad. Which will take place tomorrow. Very bad.
Have you had the haircut?
Yes. The train leaves in an hour. So keep the job tidy, huh? Your fancy hairpin is all over the press.
Don't worry. I got another one.
It's not funny.
That was a bit. They won't catch me.
They might.
They won't.
No, listen, they might.
They won't.
Make it look like suicide.
First class.
Of course.
The thing I love about that exchange is, again, it's a very standard kind of expositionary exchange that you would have in any kind of show of this sort. The one character sort of laying out the stakes and saying, okay, here's what's happened and here's what needs to happen. And yet you have this brilliant little 1 minute sort of pas de deux between these two characters where you learn so much about their relationship. He's concerned. She's not. She plays with the fact that she knows he's more concerned than she is. And there's even a couple of laugh lines in there. And I don't feel like that's the kind of thing you expect when you're watching this kind of show. When I think of procedurals, they often feel very grim, and it's very hard to shoehorn humor into them. Here, the humor feels very natural, and it's really kind of amazing. I think it's a good testament to what happens when you take a writer who's known for doing one thing and you put her into a totally different situation and give her a chance to write something else. You get something that's kind of like alchemically magical. The episode climaxes in, again, a very familiar sort of genre scene, which is the witness is in the hospital. This is the sort of situation they've just been describing. She's protected by a bunch of armed police. Eve is there to make sure that she's going to be okay. And this, again, is a situation we encounter a lot in these kind of shows and movies, is the sort of how's the assassin going to get in and pull off the impossible by eliminating this person. The thing that is amazing to me about this scene, and this is what I think Sandra Oh brings to this series, and she's got this Emmy nomination for it. On one level, it's a very fantastical show. It's got lots of sort of flights of fancy. It's got poison hairpins and international intrigue and assassins. And yet the emotional moments feel real and they feel resonant. So let's listen to the next clip. This is when Eve comes back and discovers that the hospital room in which she's left her witness is full of dead bodies, including the witness who's dying.
Dom? Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Oh, Jesus. Dom! Dom! Oh, my God, Kasha! Oh, God, Kasha! Oh, my God. Oh, Kasha. Oh, Kasha, please, please, stay with me. Oh, somebody help me! Oh, my God, somebody help me! Kasha, stay with me. Stay with me. No, no. Benja, Dobja. Benja, Dobja. No, 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 no. Oh, somebody help me!
Just listening to that again, it's giving me goosebumps. I have to say that that, you know, in a traditional kind of espionage thriller, you would see the scene and the hero would walk in and survey the bloodshed and then pull their gun out and cock it and be like, I don't know who's responsible for this, but I'm going to make them pay. And then they'd like run out of the room. And here Sandra Oh makes a completely believable scene about walking into a room full of dead people and knowing that all of them are dead because of something you did. And it's, you know, in the midst of this very fantastical show, there's these completely resonant, grounded, emotional moments. The next scene is one of my favorite ones. This next clip, again, this is probably the most familiar genre trope in the entire episode. It's the classic "you're off the case" scene, where the investigator has gone too far. They pushed the wrong buttons. They went up against the wrong person, and now their superior has to come in and tell them, "That's it. You're off the case. Turn in your badge." So here is the scene in which Eve and her boss Bill find out that they're going to be fired.
From what I've managed to gather, you have conducted an illegal investigation. You've manipulated a witness. You've put a minor in danger.
Oh, and
no, don't interrupt me, Bill. On top of that, you failed at your actual job. No doubt because you were so busy executing your pretend job, which I believe was going to earn you 20 quid. And what you both seem to think is the most important thing about this case.
No, the most important thing is that I was right about the fact...
No, the most important thing, Eve, is that four people are dead and it's all your fault.
What were you right about? Kasha described the killer as Aledeja, which means flat-chested. No one.
How do you know that?
Because I secretly recorded the interview and brought it home and asked Dom and my husband to translate it for me.
You're fired.
You're a dick swab.
Oh.
Thank you, Bill.
No, I was going to call you a dick swab.
Clearly, there's going to be some reshuffling in your department.
That is such a brilliant exchange. That scene does so many things all at once. It establishes real stakes for the show in that it's actually true that Eve's actions have led to four people being killed, and it really is her fault. And yet there's a laugh-out-loud comic payoff to the scene. They have the whole thing with the dick swab, and then Fiona Shaw as Carolyn just sweeps in at the end with like the best punchline of the whole thing about the reshuffling in her department. You know, when you watch Fleabag, it's impressive that someone could take a comedy and infuse it with like real drama. But I think it's even more impressive to take a very familiar dramatic structure and infuse it with real actual comedy that really works within the characters and actually makes you laugh. And that's what Killing Eve does. I just wanted to include the coda to the show because I feel like this exchange between Carolyn and Eve is sort of sums up everything that the first episode's been about. So Eve is fired. She gets visited at her home by Carolyn, who's the head of the Moscow operation, who essentially recruits her to become a spy, thus sending the series into motion. And this is their last exchange.
Buy some milk. Well, he'll think you're having an affair.
Oh, I don't think he'd ever think that.
They all think we're having affairs before they think we're secret agents.
Oh, no, I think Nico would assume I was an agent before ever thinking that I was having an affair.
You might want to make him think you're having an affair, then. Hope to see you Thursday.
This is such a great send-off into the rest of the series, and it sort of sums up everything that the show has been about, this idea of people being underestimated, the way that we look at someone and make assumptions about them. You know, Eve is talking about, well, my husband would never think I could be a secret agent. He'd think I'm having an affair first. And here's this other woman who's saying to her, like, challenge that idea. I'm gonna be your guide. I'm going to pull you into this new world, and you're to discover things about yourself you could never have guessed. So much of the writing on the show is that it just does so much at the same time. It's funny, it's exciting, it's dramatic, and it's also incredibly smart. I was so impressed with it. And this episode is an expertly written, beautiful acted, and awesomely directed 45 minutes of television. It's one of the best and most ingenious pilots I've ever encountered. I feel like if you were taking a course in TV writing, this is the pilot that they should show you, because it just does everything a pilot needs to do, but it does it so expertly and in such an entertaining way. And that is why I am submitting this episode, Nice Face, to the canon.
Should I start?
Yes.
Sure.
Okay. Yeah, I'll go first and then Dave can go because I think this is Sarah's first ever episode of Killing Eve, if I am not mistaken.
You are mistaken.
Oh, I realized you already watched it. Well, then you can go second. I wanted to bring up that Sandra Oh was on Close Up with the Hollywood Reporter, I think last month on the TV drama actresses episode, and talked about how she got the script and read, you know, the first few pages and thought that she was being considered for Helena until they were like, no, you would be Eve, because, and sort of used that as a jumping off point to like how much this industry like lowers women's own expectations of what's going to be asked of them. Like even for her after 10 years on Grey's Anatomy, that she thought she might be playing this very tertiary part in this show is like remarkable, especially after you watch it and think like, she's so good. Like, she's just, you can't imagine anyone else playing this part after you see her in it. She's so great. And I know there's a post on Vulture, which I'll look up and I'll link that in the show notes too, about the wardrobe on the show and how hard they had to work to make her look frumpy. Like in the first scene where she comes to the office on Saturday, like one half of her collar is out, the other is inside her jacket, her shirt is buttoned wrong. Like they had to like crumple up her clothes, put them in the dryer, like step on them and stuff just to make her look less, you know, gorgeous and elegant than she is in actuality. So the care that they've put into this character is very evident on screen. And Adam, I barely can add anything to what you've said. This is such an excellent case for an amazing episode. That's exactly what you want in a pilot and nothing that you don't, like, there's not a bit of fat on it. Watching it the second time, I was reminded how much, seeing the pilot the first time and watching the series made me want to watch everything else that Jodie Comer's ever done, which I haven't, but I'm sure I will, because she's so good. And the way she creates this character who's like a magpie of human behavior, like picking up things that she sees around her and like trying things out, and the whole bit with the throw that she gets in from the Italian guy that she kills after, like, she asks him before she kills him, hey, who made that throw on your bed, and then gets one for herself, is great, / relatable. I also want to give a shout out to Darren Boyd, who plays Frank. He was in the episode of Veep that I presented for the canon a while back, the episode where they're in England. And he's the counterpart that sort of, the antagonist to Selena in that episode. And he's so funny. And the way that he helps bring out the idea of like this, as you say, Adam, with like subverting the expectations of what a thriller is, that this office isn't like a sleek, you know, a million touch screens everywhere showing you all everything. Like, it just looks like, it looks like Dunder Mifflin. It looks totally boring. And in the first, the conflict in his first scene seems to be that he knows they were all out at a birthday party that he didn't get invited to, and he's miffed about it. Is like, again, it tells you everything you need to know about his character. A, that he's still pissy about it, and B, like, well, that's why you didn't get invited, because you're a dick. he's great. And I there's not much else to say. Everything you said is in your presentation. It's an amazing show. If you somehow haven't watched it yet, you must, everyone within the sound of my voice. And this episode is what sets it all in motion. Sarah.
I don't have a ton to add either. I am really glad that you included that clip of her wailing for help, because I think that one of the show's many gifts is seeing through the trope to how people would actually respond,
yeah,
to extraordinary situations, which is what, like, it sort of elevates this past a Brit procedural, which it's an extremely good Brit procedural, but it's also more than that. And because it is a European show, I appreciate that in shows of this type, like when a trope is being subverted, the writing does not feel the need to stand back and make a bunch of asterisks with its little, yeah, laser pointer and be like, look, we have a, you know, this is an unusual situation for a bunch of ladies to find themselves, like, okay, you know, that we get it. We're just enjoying watching it and being at the center of it. So I really liked that about it. When I was watching the pilot, Adam, I had the exact same experience as you, that like, my entire Twitter feed was full of Killing Eve for weeks. And then people I knew personally were like, you need to start watching, like texting me in the middle of the night after marathoning it themselves and being like, so it's Bunt Nip. I still haven't finished it because I started it and then the Beeb like pulled the episodes off their website and I was having trouble finding it. And then they had a marathon. So the last half of the season is waiting for me on my DVR. I'm super excited about it. I knew that this would be Dave Nip because it's the guy from The Bridge. As Constantine. Yeah. That I was like, why does that guy look familiar?
But also the way he escalates the language of that scene. Good. Also good. Very good.
Okay. Yeah.
Not so good. Bad. Yeah, it's great. I love the rhythm of that.
And just like that everyone looks like real people and that Europe understands in a way that American TV doesn't, like that normal is hot and not everyone has to look like they were extruded in a factory. TV is getting a little better about this. It is one of the things I like about Lodge 49, as I said. But yes, I really was apprehensive watching the pilot for the first time. Because it was like, oh boy, like this is, what if this is one of those things that I'm really supposed to like, and I only kind of like it? Like, what if I only think that it's like a B and I don't want to keep going and, you know, am I dead inside? Maybe I am, but it's not because I didn't like Killing Eve. I loved it. This is an excellent presentation that gets at everything that is great and different about this show and to be treasured. About Phoebe Waller-Bridge and her whole cast. Everyone is great. And I thought I'd heard all the insults that were compounds of the word dick. I had not. Welcome to the roster, Dick Swab. Make yourself at home. Dave Cole.
Yeah, I think Adam's argument covered most of the ground. So I'll just talk about some stuff that I think that is just sort of like icing on the cake. Is the density of the pilot. So much happens in this pilot without seeming too rushed, too forced, or too expositional. Like, there's multiple assassinations. There is a lot of, you know, detective work. There's a lot of co-worker relationship, you know, pegs are staked. And it doesn't seem unnatural or forced or that it's too much for a pilot. And Adam, you were saying that, you know, this is classroom material. Her other pilot on Fleabag, which is also in the canon, was similarly well constructed. So she seems to have a gift for how to present a universe that doesn't seem too foreign by the end of that season. You know, sometimes you have a pilot and you really can see the changes that happened, you know, from episode 1 to episode 10 or whatever. But this one seems like they were very assured in everything they were doing character wise. More superficially, there is a lot of travel porn kind of stuff in here. You know, a lot of great locations that they visit throughout the series. You know, the opening shot in Vienna and the ice cream place, just beautifully shot and just looks so exotic to somebody in North America. You know what I mean? Like, it's just like you don't get that here. So it's sort of like almost like a travelogue porn show within a spy thriller. Similarly, I think a lot of the kind of the fashion and commerce porn stuff that the Villeneuve brings into it because she's sort of a high class fashion enjoyer. And it's just like it's all these things just add up to such a like well-crafted production that supports the excellent writing and the excellent character development in this series. Was it this calendar year this was released? Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so yes.
I'm pretty sure this is gonna end up being my favorite show of 2018. It was just really great watch from start to end. I'm a little bit bummed to find out next season of Killing Eve, she won't be quite as hands-on Phoebe Waller-Bridge because she had to kind of choose between this and Fleabag. But, you know, that's sort of like it's a wash, right? And both shows are really great. You know, she can only head up one. So, you know, she picked and, you know, I would probably be equally sad if she wasn't doing Fleabag. So, you know, we just, you know, beyond cloning her and having her do both, I mean, you just gotta Got to do a Sophie's Choice there. So, yeah, great episode. Well argued. And somehow, if you've missed Killing Eve, you know, rectify that. Start watching it. If you're not sold on the pilot, you're not going to, you know, it's so the show that you're going to get throughout the whole season. So there you go. So shall we put this to a vote?
Let's.
Yes.
All right. Tara. Ariana.
Yay.
Sarah DeBending.
Yay.
Sure. Yay for me too. That means Killing Eve, Series 1, Episode 1, Nice Face. Thank you very much, Britton, for once in your life giving episodes titles. You are hereby inducted into the Extra Pod.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It's time for Winner and Loser of the Week. Tara has our winner.
Cord cutters. You all know how I feel about these fucking pinkos, but Jeopardy is streaming for the first time on Hulu. Apparently not current episodes, but the show has come to the streaming service with a back catalog of, I think, 60 notable episodes. So if that was the last thing that was making you keep your DirecTV or Spectrum membership, that's one less reason for you to keep it.
Okay. Loser of the week.
That would be Talking Dead and its viewers. Chris Hardwick had a quote emotional return to the show, barf, and an executive producer and several other staffers quit. Someone else hired those people post haste, and Hardwick eats some bees.
Speaking about eating bees, you know what time it is?
Bee time?
Bee time. All right, everybody. I hope you all bought your B game because this is the sixth game time of the season. Here are the season scores. Tara has 3. Sarah has 1. Value guests have 1. That's right. Today, we are playing Pros and Comic-Cons from Will Hutching, plural, who earns himself an extra credit. Sorry, Will. Redeemable for an extra hot, great mini topic of his choosing. Will writes... It seems like comic book adaptations are everywhere these days, and while they have definitely exploded over the past few years, this is hardly a new trend. Producers have been adapting shows from comic books for decades, and there are no signs of stopping. That is true. Will has put together a list of 51 TV shows adapted from comic books. You need to tell me the title of the show based on his clues, which are many. You get the year it debuted, the network it debuted on, and a description of the show, and just for funsies, for some reason, he put him in haiku form.
Okay.
You're going to get the year, the network,
like,
and a haiku synopsis of the show. For 2 points, name the show. If you're still not sure of yourself, ask for a hint. I'll give you the lead actor, after which the correct answer is worth 1 point.
Okay.
All right. Steel meal situation, please, Tara.
Thank you for asking. Sarah D. Bunting has 2 steel meals. I have 1 valued guests. Sorry, Adam, have 0.
Oh, that's a shame.
Oh.
All right, let's sort the picky.
May I ask, if you take a swing on the 2 points and you miss it, do you get to ask for the hint? No. Okay.
We will start with Tara.
All right, Tara, Sarah, Adam is our order today. Are we ready to play pros and comic cons?
Yeah.
Pinkos right. And Comic-Cons? Yes, got it.
Here we go. Tara, and we're going in chronological order to give you sort of a sense of where you are in the TV world. So I thought that might help you out a bit. So we're starting way back in 1952. This syndicated show described as such. And by the way, last time we did a haiku game, there were some that were like 8 syllables, according to some people. I didn't count them all. So if somebody's, if you feel like the syllables are off, like, take it up with Will, okay?
I'm lodging a
protest. IQ truthers not welcome.
It's just going to say scantia truthers.
Disguised by glasses, a mild-mannered reporter. Look, up in the sky.
Superman?
Yeah, I'm going to give you that. The further back in time we go, the more generous I'm going to be with the actual title of the shows. That's The Adventures of Superman with George Reeves.
The one that Ben Affleck played the guy.
The Hollywood Land,
himself or whatever, yeah.
Sarah D.
George
Bunting,
Reeves.
Your Thank first you, show. 1966, jumping 14 years ahead. This was originally on ABC. Na 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 title drop.
Batman.
Batman is good for 2 points. Adam Sternberg's first question accelerated now to the 70s. We have 75 ABC, Amazon Princess, From War to the 70s, Invisible Plane.
Dun, 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 Wonder Woman.
You know, Wonder Woman, every time we talk about Wonder Woman, I don't actually think about Wonder Woman or the lasso or the twirling. I think about the computer, Ira.
Yeah.
We had a Jewish supercomputer. It was weird. Tara Ariano, yeah. Also 1970. Oh, this is 1974. So oh, I guess my chronological order was a little bit of a white lie.
All right.
Going back 1 year. CBS, a boy and his mentor drive around in an RV. Say the magic word. And before we get into things that aren't superheroes, I want to remind you, these are all comic book adaptations, not necessarily just superheroes.
Yeah, so. No, I got it. Hint.
Michael Gray was a lead in this 1974 comic book adaptation.
I don't know. Johnny Quest? I know that's not right.
Incorrect. That is also an upcoming movie, Shazam. Shazam. Oh. Say the magic word. The magic word being Shazam.
Got it.
In conclusion, Shazam. 1977 CBS, Sarah. News photographer bitten by an arachnid. Jameson a nice guy?
Spider-Man?
Yeah, I'm going to give that to you. Full title, The Amazing Spider-Man. The Amazing
Yes, Spider-Man. I'm sorry.
Adam Sternberg, 78 CBS. Lonely wanderer. Wouldn't like when he's angry. Sadly hitchhiking.
I'm gonna have to say The Incredible Hulk.
Yes, correct. That's the wrong one. There we go.
I would just like to say that I have literally and personally watched every single show that we've mentioned so far.
Wow.
So I would like to thank you for choosing a game time where I actually have a fighting chance, at least until we get into like the 90s and stuff.
Even the original
Superman?
This
was my childhood, basically.
How do we get a little too inside baseball? But I had another game lined up and I looked at it and I thought, oh, Sternberg stands absolutely no chance at this one. We'll play in a couple of weeks, probably. So switch gears to the comic book adaptation one. So it was a little bit deliberate, but I think these are all relatively well-known shows for the most part. There's a couple of gotchas in here. So I think this is a pretty even keel for this week.
Adam, I believe, too, that The Incredible Hulk is one of your least favorite comic stars.
He is one of my, and he is one. In fact, not to get into it, but like there's an inverse relationship to comic book heroes I liked as a kid and comic book heroes who are prominent in pop culture right now. Because probably my three least favorite were The Incredible Hulk, Thor, and Doctor Strange.
I thought Iron Man.
Iron Man too. All of them were bad for reasons I could get into at a later date.
Okay.
Weren't you a Daredevil person?
I like Daredevil, Batman, X-Men. I mean, they also are prominent. Don't get me wrong. I mean, there's no way that like a nerd from the 70s can complain that like comic books aren't big enough in our culture right now. They don't have a creeper movie yet. But it's yes, the Hulk, the fact that they've made the Hulk and Thor like entertaining characters to watch in a full-length movie is kind of like a weird magic trick performed by Kevin Feige and Marvel because those characters are actually terrible.
All right.
I just remember there was a frog Thor at some point in comic books. And there's like a horse creature Thor. It gets a little weird. Anyways, let's get back to the game. Tara Ariano, 1989, zooming ahead 11 years, HBO anthology show hosted by Ghoulish Muppet. Creepy tales, bad puns.
Is this Tales from the Crypt?
Tales from the Crypt. Good for 2 points. Sarah Bunting, 1990, USA Network. Freak lab accident. Scientist, now living plant, lives in the wetlands.
Scientist, now living plant?
Yeah.
Hint.
Starring Dick Durock.
which, by the way, is my new name. Please, now, for the rest of the show, refer to me as Dick Durock.
Thanks for the tip, Dick. I don't know. The Adventures of Audrey.
But I can't. I cannot steal.
You can.
Right?
You can't get a point. But please tell us what it is.
Yes.
Swamp Thing.
Swamp Thing. All right, Adam. Here's your actual question.
He was a plant.
Real points.
Yes, he's made of plants.
Yeah. 1990. Also, CBS. Forensic expert struck by lightning can run fast. Scientist girlfriend.
Forensic expert. 1990.
Yeah.
I mean. I know who I want to say. Mm-hmm. The Flash.
You are correct. With your good friend, Sarah and Tara, John Wesley Shipp.
Yes. Wesley.
1993, Tara. ABC. Yep. Old tale rom-com spin. Hero, reporter, in love. Her clone ate a frog.
I believe this is The Adventures of Lois and Clark.
Yeah, that's close enough.
Or just Lois and Clark.
Lois and Clark, colon, the new adventures of Superman.
Oh, Jesus. Yes. Settle down, ABC.
Sarah Bunting, 96, ABC. Enchanting young girl lives with two magic aunts and a talking cat.
Sabrina the Teenage Witch?
Correct.
Nice.
All right, Adam Sternberg, we're going to find out how many episodes back Adam Sternberg has been listening to the podcast. 1997, in syndication, jazz saxophonist hears evil thoughts of others. Big, goofy, red eye.
Okay, I definitely had heard you talking about this show. I have been trying to seek it out and watch it myself. I want to say it's called Nightman.
Yeah.
It's called Nightman. You bet your booty it is.
I don't know how I missed that when it was on television, because that is my wheelhouse, that show. I live inside.
You have to buy
house.
It. You have to really like want to watch it. You have to buy it on iTunes.
That's right.
It may not have aired in Canada, too. That's also part of it, because it was in syndication. Canada.
It definitely was a WUTV Buffalo Channel 29 TV show, if ever there was one.
There was 20% of me that when you were talking about it, I thought that maybe you were still on cold medication. And you were just hallucinating.
Sometimes I think about Nightman, and I'm just like, I just smile and think to myself, you know, sometimes the world just sort of like makes sense and things happen for a reason. That reason is I'm delighted decades later. It's just a fantastic thing that happened. 1997 ABC, Tara.
Yep.
Future officer protecting our history, policing his past.
Oh, no.
I'm just letting you know, we're getting into a few hard ones for everybody. You're towards the end of the ramp round one, let's call it.
I would expect nothing less from Dick Durock. Hint.
All right, your lead is Ted King.
Nope.
Yeah.
The greatest American hero, not the correct answer.
Is not the correct answer. Anybody want to take a guess?
Nope.
That one I don't know.
All right. Also turned into a movie with Jean-Claude Van Damme.
Time Cop.
I assume it's the same source material.
Oh, wow.
Time Cop. 1998, Sarah. In syndication. Undead musician avenging his dead girlfriend. Brought back by Black Bird.
Undead musician.
Yeah.
Hint.
Mark Della Dacalos.
of the intercourse Dacalos. I don't know. Jazz man.
No, incorrect. The hint there was Blackbird. That was The Crow. : Stairway to Heaven, but we would have accepted just The Crow. All right, Adam Sternberg, here is our question's going to take us into our first score break. 1999. A number. Fox. Army lieutenant trapped in a virtual world hunting dictator.
Army lieutenant trapped in a virtual world hunting dictator.
This is going to be one of those answers where you're probably not going to get it, but once I see what it is, you're like, oh yeah, that those 3 years where all those shows happened.
Wait, is it like a Y2K show?
1999.
Trapped in a virtual world. God, again, in my wheelhouse. I'm just going to take a guess at what I would title this show if I was a Fox executive in 1998.
Okay.
Killing Hitler.
It's one of the many, how can we replicate the X-Files success comic book adaptations? Harsh Realm.
Oh, Jesus. Oh, yes. Yeah. That guy from Farty of Pive.
And
remember that show?
Brother sister show to Spooky Links. What was it
Freaky
called?
Links.
Yeah. Spooky Links.
All right,
Freaky
that's Links. Our first score break. Let's hear it.
Well, Adam is running away with this with 8 points. Just kidding. It's pretty close. Sarah and I have 6 points each.
All right. That means Tara and Sarah, you are both in the Equalizer Challenge Zone.
Good luck, guys.
He turns on, puts on his glasses, turns on his light. So we're playing for 4 points, of which you will split for 2 points each.
Correct.
You get
so
half
tie it
of
up.
These six Trivial Pursuit TV card questions. Are you ready?
Yes.
Yes.
Classics. Now, this was not planned. What superhero became the first alien to star in a weekly TV series in 1953? Were you paying attention?
Was it Superman?
Sitcom. Who once asked Ozzie Nelson, how can I get a permanent if you won't tell me whether you want me to or not? I don't need to tell me that I can't say that word because I know.
Okay.
Harriet?
It's Ozzie and Harriet, right? Yeah, Harriet.
Harriet Nelson is your answer?
Yes.
Drama, get this, and you have 2 points each. What family-focused series spanned Christmas 1933 to Thanksgiving 1947?
I'm going to say The Waltons.
I agree.
All right.
Hey!
You got your 2 points now. Remember, if you run the card, we're double your points. Kids and Games.
Hey. Yep.
What mouse's tail did X-rated animator Ralph Bashy update in the late 80s? What mouse's tail did X-rated animator Ralph Bashke update in the late 80s?
I know that's the Fritz the Cat guy. I don't know if there's a mouse, or should we just say Mickey Mouse, like he did a porny Mickey Mouse?
I don't know if it's Ignatz. Yeah, let's just say Mickey Mouse.
Okay. Damn
Mighty
it.
Mouse.
Mighty oh.
Mouse. Yeah. All right. Well, you got your 2 points, but not your 4 points. So quickly, that's all tied up, right?
Yes.
All tied up. All right. Here we go. Question 16. Tara Ariano.
Yep.
2001. We're now in the aughts. TNT. Okay. Cop finds old bracelet. Pursued by creepy rich guy. Gets magic powers. Wait, let me say that last line. Gets magic powers.
TNT.
TNT.
Hint.
All right. This is a good hint. Yancey Butler.
Is it? Well, God. Was this Witchblade?
Wow.
What a journey you went on, Tara.
That's great. I'm going to give you a Dave point for that, too, because I found that surprising that you got that right. Sarah D. Bunting, also 2001, our first show from the WB. Before the Red Cape, weirdness happens in small town. But no flight, no tights.
Oh, Smallville.
Smallville.
Omar.
Adam Sternberg, your first question from the new millennium on Fox, 2001. Big blue guy and friends hanging out in a diner. Heroes don't do much.
The Tick.
The Tick. Correct. Tara Ariano, 2002. Yes. The WB. Batman's grown daughter. Paralyzed vigilante team up to fight crime.
Birds of prey.
Correct. Sarah Bunting, 2006. Spike TV around anymore? Did they rename?
No, it's the Paramount Network.
Paramount now. Yeah.
Half human, half vamp. Trails secret society named after his swords.
Blah. Hint.
All right, your lead actor is Sticky Fingers.
Of course.
Yeah.
What?
That's what the
Z. The intercourse sticky fingers.
The East Hampton fingerses.
Half human, half vamp. Trail secret society named after his sorts.
I don't know if this is a thing, but From Dusk Till Dawn?
Oh, that's a good guess. Incorrect. This is Blade.
Oh.
There was a show of From Dusk Till Dawn.
There was, though. Okay.
Matador or something?
Oh, yes.
El Rey.
Yeah. 2010, Adam. AMC, post-apocalypse, survivors band together. Watch out for walkers.
Walking Dead,
sure. 2010, also, Tara, on Fox.
Yep.
Former assassin protects people who need it by drawing the fire.
Int?
Mark Paul Valley.
Not Gotham is my answer.
technically correct in the Cliff Clavin three guys never been in my kitchen kind of way, but that is Human Target.
Oh.
Human Target.
Oh, yeah, that thing.
Sarah D. Bunting, 2012, The CW. Former castaway, Bo Shirtless Salmon Ladder, in quotes, "You've failed this city." Bo Shirtless Salmon Ladder? Yeah, like the fish.
Uh-huh.
Well, the Salmon Ladder is like it's an American Ninja thing where you like project your... You look it up.
You've killed the wonder. All right, let me read that again for you, Sarah. former castaway, Bo Shirtless Salmon Ladder. You failed this city.
Can you spell Bo, please?
Sarah, do you want me to spell Bo for you?
Okay, sorry.
Wouldn't hurt.
B-O-W.
Oh, yeah. That would help. Thank you. I was like, Bo, B-A-E-A-U? Like, what? What is
that? That's why I asked.
Oh, shit. And I never remember that lead actor's name anyway, so I'm just going to guess that this is Arrow. Thanks, Tara.
I hope you win by 1 point now, Sarah. Adam Sternberg.
I won't.
2013, ABC. He survived Loki, leads a team of super spies, tied to the movies.
I want to say the title correctly. Is it Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.?
No.
You forgot Agents all the S.H.I.E.L.D.? Periods?
No. It's Marvel's agent of S-H-I-E-L-D.
I knew it.
Tar Arietta, 1914, yes. Fox. One
Wait,
good
what
detect-
year?
1914. I mean, 1914.
A rocket flies into
One good detective, corrupt cops and crime bosses, predates the bat suit. 1914 on Fox Entertainment Channel Vision.
Of Flatbush.
Now available at your local Nickelodeon. Go see it.
This is
only
this
a nickel.
Not Human Target. Gotham.
Gotham. That was, in fact, in case you missed it, 2014. Sarah D. Bunting, 2014, The CW. The CW ran faster than light. He broke the timeline again. God damn it, Barry.
The Flash.
Yes, the second The Flash answer of our game. Adam Sternberg, 2014, NBC. Brit Demon Hunter, caught between heaven and hell, hopes to save his soul.
I believe that was the ill-fated TV Constantine.
Correct. I think they brought him back, right? He's in Legends of Tomorrow now or something.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Tara Ariano.
Yes, sir.
2015, ABC.
Yep.
Post-war USA. Bot spies. Patriarchy. More than just Cap's ex.
Agent Carter.
Agent Carter, correct. Sarah D. Bunting, 2015, Netflix. Teenaged trillionaire made fuel from vegetables. Cue wacky hijinks. Comic book adaptation, Netflix, 2015.
Teenaged millionaire.
Trillionaire.
Trillionaire. Excuse me. Trillionaire. Hint.
Jake Brennan is your lead. Jake Brennan.
Jake Brennan. You're welcome.
Let the wide stick give you the edge. Speed stick, super dry, antiperspirant.
Jake Brennan. Thank you.
By Wesson. I don't know this one. Wesson Man?
Richie Rich. Richie Rich.
Fuck off.
All right, this is going to take us under a second score break. This is question 30. It is 2015 Netflix. Sightless attorney fighting crime in red leather, hallway ass kicking.
This is for me, yes?
Yeah.
It is Daredevil.
It is Daredevil, correct. And it is our second score break.
All right. Adam is still in the lead with 18 points. I have 15 points. Sarah has 14 points.
All right, Sarah, this is yours and yours alone. You are in the Grossworth Equalizer Challenge Zone. Here we go. Classics.
Good luck, Sarah. Thank you.
What TV buddies were played by Bob Denver and Dwayne Hickman? What TV buddies were played by buddies? Bob Denver and Dwayne Hickman?
Gilligan and the Skipper?
Menard G. Krebs and Dobie Gillis. Sitcoms.
Menard.
Hmm?
It's Maynard. It's not Menard.
It is it is Maynard. You're right.
I know.
Once again, Bunkport Menards.
Menards of California. Great department store. Sitcoms. What was the first sitcom to treat viewers to the sound of a flushing toilet? I think we've had this card before. Or this question before, anyway.
The sound of a flushing toilet?
Oh, first Jesus. Sitcom to treat the viewers to the sound of a flushing toilet. I think this was in the first TV pack we did. Yeah.
Yeah, I think
all
it was.
All in the Family?
Yeah, All in the Family. Right.
Nice.
Drama. What soap opera featured cameos by Oprah Winfrey, Dick Cavett, Ed Koch, and Liz Taylor?
General Hospital.
All My Children. All My Children.
Sure.
Kids and Games. What shows folks love to hunt the Snorkosaurus?
The Snorkosaurus?
Snorkosaurus.
The Storks? I don't know. I don't know.
Snorkosaurus, dinosaurs, the Flintstones. All right. You need these last two to claim your points.
Good luck. Shit.
Who left Gunsmoke, then in quotes, to be a leading man instead of a second banana? What actor?
Clint Eastwood?
Sorry, this is Stars. Dennis Weaver. Dennis Weaver. Our last question, the answer was Menard. Wow. What are the odds? All right. Ready to get back into the game? Still a lot of game left, guys. So, you know, if you're behind, plenty of time to catch up. We start with Tara. 2015. It was funny that the first, like, five decades took up, like, the first 15 questions.
Yeah.
2015, the CW. Undead coroner. Brains change personality. Memories solve crimes.
iZombie.
2015, CBS. Sarah D. Bunting. Followed her cousin, a hero in her own right, works for a Martian.
Is it really 2015? Supergirl.
Adam Sternberg, also 2015, Netflix. Private detective was traumatized by her past. Hits hard, drinks harder.
Jessica Jones.
2016, Tara, the CW. Good guys and bad guys bouncing throughout history. Don't call them heroes.
Legends of Tomorrow.
Sarah D. Bunting, 2016. Fox, Devil in L.A., runs his own nightclub downtown, and he fights crime now.
Lucifer?
Ugh, yeah. You know, that's
on Netflix now. I've been seeing tweets about it. Like, who wanted that?
Such a good comic book. That comic book is like really, really, really good. And the show is like fucking like it's like one step above Future Cop with Ernest Borgnine. It's
can't believe that wasn't on here.
To be clear, Netflix is making new episodes. I do not know why.
Who knows? Adam Sternberg, 2016, our first show on the SIFI network, otherwise known as Sci-Fi. Lawman's descendant defends hometown from demons with a magic gun.
Oh, it's Winona Earp.
You are correct. Thank
you. Favorite of past guest, Mo Ryan.
Yeah, totally. That show's champion for sure. Tara Ariano, 2016, AMC. Small town minister. Killer girlfriend, vampire pal. Trying to find God.
Preacher.
Sarah D. Bunting, 2016, SIFI Network. Woke up from coma. World overrun by vampires. Her blood can cure them.
Hint.
Kelly Overton.
I'm going to guess Vancouver's own Kelly Overton.
Yeah, based the on Black the Box Chronicles. Yeah, I have no idea.
Apparently there is a series for Van Helsing.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
that
yeah.
Thing.
But this time she's a lady. Right. Adam Sternberg, 2016, Netflix. Ex-con turned hero. Bullet hole ridden hoodies. Cop with robot arm.
Oh, I haven't watched this show, and I thought I knew it until the very last line. Cop with robot arm. I'm going to guess Luke Cage.
Correct.
Is there a cop with a robot arm in
that
show?
Yeah, one of the characters loses an arm, and Iron Fist sets them up.
Haiku spoilers.
Yeah, sorry. I was trying to be vague. 2017, The CW. Dark take on small town. Serpents and jingle jangle. Bughead and Varchi.
Riverdale.
Dirty Bunting, 2017, FX. The Professor's Son. Schizophrenic telepath. Fighting Shadow King.
Oh, I'm not going to remember the name of this, but why not take a hint anyway?
All right. Your lead actor is Dan Stevens, and the title of this TV show is also shared by one of the greatest movies of all time.
Which I think we watched with Adam in our apartment in New York.
Oh, no doubt.
Ago.
Oh, yes.
Bring It On was a comic book? I do not know the answer to this question.
All right. The answer is Legion. Legion.
Pigeon.
All right, Adam, 2017 Netflix. Rich kid in plane crash. Destined martial arts hero. Screws up royally.
Boo. Iron Fist.
All right, Ariano.
Yes.
Also 2017, also Netflix. Yep. Four heroes team up, protecting New York City. Fist still a dumbass.
The Defenders.
All right, Sarah D. Bunting, bring us into our last score break. 1917 plus 100 years. Yeah, sorry, that's the next question. This is the score break, isn't it? Yes.
Okay, yep.
2017, Amazon, Big Blue Crime Fighter, guy in a high-tech moth suit, crazy old villain.
The Tick.
Yes, the second The Tick. All right, this is our last question before the last score break. Adam Sternberg, 2017, A, B, C. City on the Moon. Superpowered Royalty. Teleporting Dog.
Oh, man, that sounds like you just read that off somebody's fridge magnet poetry collection. City on the Moon, Teleporting Dog.
Also sounds
ABC.
Like things Jasper would say after he came out of the freezer.
This is a show that's on ABC now, huh?
Well, teleporting maybe. Dog
it was at that time.
Hint, please.
Anson Mount. The Bounty.
Ooh, I have no idea. Is it called Arcadia?
That was Inhumans. Inhumans.
Oh, yeah. Everyone hated it. That's all I remember.
Oh, that. Yes.
All right. Everybody has two questions left. Let's get the scores. Still,
okay, it's a very close game. Adam has 26 points. I have 25 points. Sarah DeBunting has 20 points.
20 points. That means... Whoa! Keep Elijah Challenge up. You're in it. Here we go. Classics.
Good luck, Sarah.
Who was the first person to star, direct, produce, and write his own series in 1952?
Jackie Gleason.
Oh my God, I thought you were going to get it for a second. Nope, sorry. Jack Webb. Jack Webb.
Oh.
I was like, holy shit. yeah, instant no. win.
Come on.
Sitcom. What M asterisk A asterisk S asterisk H character kept trying to get a Section 8 mental discharge?
Klinger.
Klinger, 1 point. You need two more for the points. Drama. What ABC drama did Newsweek say is The Big Chill as it might have been made by Woody Allen?
30-something?
Kids and Games. Who was bald-headed? Kukla, Fran, or Ollie?
Oh, shit. Ollie.
Kukla.
Ah!
What are those?
Puppets, I think.
Okay.
I think so, yeah.
Stars.
What is the answer?
Kukla.
Oh.
Yeah. Kukla.
I don't know what they are, what show that's from or anything.
I think they were puppets from, it's an old children's show from like the 1950s. Or
the Kukla, Fran, and Ollie. Kuklas.
Yeah, that was the title.
Oh, okay.
I knew that. I've never seen
it. Yeah, I did know. I just wasn't, never watched it.
Yeah.
What? This is Stars. What future talk show host got his big break when he filled in on short notice for an unconscious Red Skelton?
For an unconscious Red Skelton?
Yeah. Future talk show host.
Phil Donahue?
Oh. Johnny Carson. All right. Oh. You need this last question to get your points. This is wild card. What watch was hyped in TV ads? It takes a licking and keeps on ticking. Freebie.
Yeah, that is. I'm actually wearing one right now. That's a Timex.
It is a Timex. So you got two more points. So quickly scores again.
Okay.
Wait, do I get two or four?
She gets four.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. Four. Yeah. My bad.
Adam has 26 points. I have 25 points. Sarah has 24 points.
4 points, but take back 2 points. The honor the Hebrew God whose game time this is.
No.
Tara Ariano.
Shut up, Dick.
2017. Fox. Mutant family running from the government. An explosive pair.
Oh, no. What was this called? We watched it.
I think what is it still called, I think.
Yeah, no, it still is. But, I mean, we stopped watching it.
Uh-huh.
Therefore, it has ceased to exist.
Telling me that I know what show it is, telling me it's Star won't help. The Family. I know that's not it.
The Gifted. The
Barf. Oh, yeah.
Sarah D. Bunting, 2017, Netflix and Channel 4. Ooh. Two Brit teenagers. He may be a psychopath. Road trip cross England.
Oh, damn it. I know what this is, and the star will not help.
The Family.
Of the Gennaborgport families. I do not know the answer to this question.
Sorry.
The End of the Fucking World. End.
Oh, right. Yes. Shit.
Adam Sternberg, 2017 sci-fi. Hero cop turned hitman. Invisible unicorn. Hunting bad Santa.
Oh, yeah.
This one I know. It's Happy.
It is Happy.
There
correct.
You go.
Man.
Tara Ariano, 2017 Hulu. Hulu.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Six young teens hang out. Learn parents are in a cult and they have powers.
Runaways?
Runaways, correct. Well done.
Nice.
Sarah D. Bunting, Netflix 2017. X Special Forces. Family killed, wants revenge, lots of dead bad guys.
Hint.
John Bernthal. Bernthal.
Bernthal.
Bernthal. Bernthal?
Bernthal.
Bernthal? That sounds like a Game of Thrones name.
Of the Long Beach.
You know nothing, John Bernthal.
Is this the Punisher?
This is the Punisher. All right, here's our last question for Adam. 2018. The CW. Ex-hero teacher. Then his kids are in danger. Makes shocking comeback.
Oh, this is Black Lightning.
Black Lightning, correct 2 points. That is our last question. Tara, the scores.
Well, Sarah ended with 25 points. I had 27 points. Adam D. Sternberg had 30 points.
Wow, nicely done, ooh, Adam. Taking Adam. It for value guess. Let's play what we're going to be. What was that?
He said he ate that Sternberger.
Oh, no. Well, think about what that means in house language. That's disgusting. Yes. All right. I have two tiebreaker questions, which are now going to be played for future use steel meals. First person to shout out the correct name of the show wins that steel meal. All right. Question one.
Yes.
2018 sci-fi. Please wait until I've finished the haiku. Legend's ancestor fights to save his whole planet. It still go boom.
Krypton?
Krypton.
Good job, Tara.
2018 Freeform. Two teens meet by chance, connected by accident. Light and the darkness.
Cloak and Dagger.
Cloak and Dagger for the value job. Guess. Nice.
That's supposed to be good.
Tara! Tara.
No.
No.
Adam won. Adam won.
Oh, yeah.
Valued guest.
Oops, how embarrassing. Sorry, Adam. Well done. That is it for another episode of Extra Hot. Great, guys. And Maynard, we did the secret handshake to start our discussion of AMC's Lodge 49. And after wishing a fine mahawk to you all, we went around the dial with stops at Insecure, Babylon Berlin, Newspaper Man, and 4K TV interfaces. Adam killed his canon pitch for the Killing Eve premiere. We crowned winners and losers of the week. And Adam...
Valued guest!
Playing it twice because I screwed up, was the winner of this week's Game Time. Remember...
We're listening.
I am... what's my name? Dick
Durock.
Durock.
Dick Durock. And on behalf of Tara Ariano.
Somebody help!
Sarah D. Bunting.
Signs and symbols, Ernie.
And Adam Sternberg.
An augury of birds.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time, right here on Extra Hot Crate.
I'm going to try to throw up. I suggest you do too.
This has been a production of the Previously.tv Podcast Network.